Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, Anna. Welcome to talking to me again.
Hi, Shireen. Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous.
Right, that's the show. We have best-selling author Hari Ziad with us today. We talk about their best-selling memoir, debut memoir, Black Boy Out of Time. It is so beautiful, and we talk all about their upbringing, what it was like writing this, the inner child work they've done. It is so beautiful. We've had a great conversation.
Yeah, so stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Ready?
Oh, I already started.
We're ready. We're going. We're already going. It's fine. Hi, Anna.
How are you?
I'm good. I don't know. I feel like I don't know what else to say anymore, but I'm alive and going through it and glad that people are getting vaccinated. You know, it's another day. Every day feels like Monday. It's another Monday.
Right. It's Monday, but it's Thursday, right?
Thursday.
Wow.
Thursday.
Sorry. For a second, I get lost sometimes in the days of the week.
But this will come out on a Monday. So I was kind of right.
Yes, you're right. So it's okay, guys, for all life purposes, it's Monday. We don't want to confuse you as much as we're always confused as to what day it is.
Yeah.
It's laundry day for me.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I also do have an ongoing insufferable bit on Twitter where it's any day of the week. It's like Wednesday. And I say, like, I can't believe it's Monday again tomorrow. And people get mad at me. But it's too late. I've already committed to the bit. So... But yeah, we're really excited to talk to our guest today. It's been a long time coming. They are so talented. They've written a debut memoir that is best-selling. And yeah, let's just bring them right in. Hari Ziad is here with us today. Hello. Thank you for being here.
You're an author. Like Shireen said, you wrote this book called Black Boy Out of Time. You're editor-in-chief of Race Bader with an R, no E at the end. An R. That I was like kept looking that up and I was like, why am I spelling this wrong? And then I was like, duh, you know how to do this. But yeah, you've been writing for a ton of online publications. Do we have publications anymore? It's all online for a long time now. And actually, that's kind of how I came across you originally. So when I got the email, you know, asking, are you interested in having Hari on? I was like, wait, that can't be. They would never us. And then I was like, because that's truly how when I get excited when guests come in, because I'm just alone all the time, that I have to kind of bring energy to myself or I'll rot away in quarantine. But like, I got so excited.
I'm excited to be here. Do you remember the article that it was? It's been so many over the years.
I mean, I think it was... Oh, God. Paste? I think it was... I read a lot of Paste, but I don't know if that was what it is, because it's either Paste or Gawker. I can't recall. It's all the sites all start to look the same because they all have that same interface. I don't know if it's one company making it all.
Right.
For Paste, I did a lot of TV reviews.
Okay, see, that makes sense because...
That would make sense for Anna. That pans out. That checks.
Wait, what were you covering for Paste? Remind me, because I do actually now want to narrow down what...
I did a couple things. I did Insecure the most, like, consistently. Yeah. Like, I was doing that on a weekly basis. And then I would come in. I covered HBO's The Night Of for an episode.
That might have been it.
Well, yeah.
Because we talked about that show a lot on our show,
But I also feel like I read some other stuff of yours. I just know of you. Like, I know of you as, like, a writer. And I've seen your work.
It's pretty sick that you're here.
But I also feel like it might have just been Race Bader as well, because I have been to that site as well. Because, I creep around on the internet trying to read interesting takes because there's nothing interesting in mainstream media, you know? So you're like, well, I need like real critical thinking. I can't do this anymore. So you're one of the voices I always remember looking at.
Yeah, I don't mean to put you on the spot or anything. I'm just always curious.
I'll find that article.
That resonated with people.
I'll find it. Yeah. Look out for an email.
I'm glad to be here.
I really want to talk about Black Boy Out of Time.
Oh, yes.
But I feel like we need to get a little bit of history so our audience understands who you are. So let's start from the top. Where were you raised? Where were you born?
I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I live in Brooklyn now. I moved here about 10 years ago. That sounds so wild to say. Came here for undergrad and I've been here ever since. But from Cleveland, that's where my mother is from as well. Like most Black people in the Midwest, my extended family is from down south, Alabama and Tennessee.
Nice. Did you know that you were interested in writing when you were a kid or a teenager? Or
yeah, I knew I was interested in being a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what form it would take. I remember like the moment that I knew I was like for sure going to tell stories was related to when my father first brought a VHS recorder camera home when I was like five or so. And I was like playing around with that. But storytelling is kind of just like a very big part of my family. My mother was an educator and she did a lot of work with like families and youth. And one of the things that she always was promoting was to read to your children in the womb. Oh. So she did that.
Wow.
My mother was Hare Krishna. And that's a very like story-based, myth-based religion. And so like we grew up with pictures of all different pastimes across the house, and we would read to my mother like while she was cooking and stuff, like she would make us do that. So stories were like just a part of life growing up, and mm-hmm. it just made sense to continue that.
Wow. Now, were both your parents born and raised in Ohio?
My mother was born in Ohio and her mother had just moved there from Alabama. My dad is from Tennessee, but he spent most of his adult life in Ohio and that's where they met.
Now, your father, now correct me if I'm wrong, is Muslim, correct?
Yes.
Do you kind of know the history of that, like how, where it came into his family or any of that?
Yeah, so he's Muslim by way of the Nation of Islam. Okay. He's not in the nation anymore, but he's in part of like an offshoot of that. And so like my mother, he's also a convert. And he doesn't really, was like one of the first Black Muslims in his family.
Oh, wow. Oh, interesting.
And my mother, she converted into Hinduism with her mother. And they're like the only two who were Hindu in their family. And so I have a big... Most of my extended family are like Baptist Christian.
Wow. That's fascinating.
How do you know how your mom and her mother kind of found that? Because you write about it a lot in the book. And I think that really drew me in because I was like, that's such an interesting path to take, especially if you're coming out of like the Baptist church.
Yeah. So my grandmother was just kind of always on this journey. Like she was in the Church of Latter-day Saints for a little while. She also was in the Nation of Islam for a moment. And she just was always searching for something. And in the book, I had a lot of conversations with my mother about this. And she's like, I don't know if I necessarily would phrase it that way. But I think that so much of it was that there was not a lot of spaces where they felt safe as like Black women. And so their spiritual journey was tied to them trying to find, you know, space where they could just exist. And so it took them through lots of different things. And somehow they settled on this Hare Krishna tradition. And so when my mother and her mother's guru came to the U.S., they were able to like read some of his scripture and they drove all the way out to where he was in Dallas and were like, we're getting initiated and we're not going to let anyone stop us.
Cool.
And faced a lot of like anti-Black racism in the temple. But ever since then, they were committed to it and became a very big presence within ISKCON. And my mother was kind of like a minister figure. Growing up in the Hare Krishna tradition was a very big part of my life, which is why I write about it so much.
Yeah, I mean, you can really sense that in the writing. I also think it's so, like, it makes sense that both of your parents, in their own right, separated from their family for spiritual reasons, right? Like, not like, I'm sure they still talk, but from what it sounds like, they both wanted something more as far as spirituality is concerned. And sounds like they related to each other on that front.
Yeah. A question that I get more often about their relationship is like, oh, and Hindu and a Muslim, like, how did that work? But I think exactly what you're saying, like, their journeys had taken them through their spirituality in such a way that the journeys is what resonated more so than like where right. they ended up.
Not and the so specifics they also did, of the religions. Yeah. It's more just like, oh, you understand what I also was seeking.
Right, right. And so we might have ended up in different places, but like the fact that you were seeking this out, like I really understand that. And so, yeah, it made it work. It was never really like a lot of religious tension in, at all growing up. But we were mostly raised in the Hare Krishna tradition and mm-hmm. in the temple.
What was that like as a child? And I imagine you maybe were one of the few children that you probably knew, if the only child that was raised that way in Cleveland, Ohio. What was that like for you? Did you realize that it was like atypical?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, my mother was kind of like a minister. And so one of the things that she made her life's work was to create a community in Cleveland. So it was very small, but it was significant enough that I didn't feel like the only one. Mm. And I mean, I also grew up with, I have 18 siblings. So even if just us, I probably wouldn't have felt like the only one. But there was a decent amount of devotees in the Cleveland area. Before I was born, there was actually a temple in the Cleveland area. And it got shut down. And then she kind of started to do like home services. And she was doing that up until she left Cleveland a couple of years ago. But yeah, definitely with the larger community, I was aware that like, oh, this isn't really what everybody else is experiencing. But because we were homeschooled and because we had such a big family and mm-hmm. because our community in Cleveland was so tight knit, it didn't really start to settle in that way, framing it as like, oh, I'm like just different from everyone else until I was like probably in middle school. But as a child, I was like, oh, this is just life.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. What happened in middle school for you yeah. that you think shifted?
Well, for one, I was much more interested. I was like starting to make more friends in my community. And my mother would always try to homeschool us up until high school. And so I knew that that was coming up. And I wanted to hasten that. And so I was... just searching for a way to make that transition a little smoother. And in doing that, I was just exposed to a lot more of the wider world. And just as someone who was like gaining more independence, like I think that's part of it too. But I think also around that time is when I started to realize a lot of the parts of that life that didn't feel safe for me, especially as someone who was queer and didn't know it at the time or didn't have language for it at the time. And so I was starting to reject a lot of what I associated with my mother's inability to accept that. Mm-hmm. And so much of that was tied to her religion. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was definitely a big part of why I was interested in finding community elsewhere.
Right.
You had 18 siblings. I'm very curious how that experience was for you.
So my mother had 10 kids and my dad had 12 uh-huh. and they had three together. They were like each other's last marriage. Right. So it's 18 altogether. And I grew up mostly with like my mother's 10 kids. Like we're all very close. Uh-huh. And there's some kids on my dad's side that I'm less close to. So altogether there's 18 of us. But sometimes I'm just like, oh, there's 10 because of my mother's kids, which is still a lot. mm-hmm. It was, I don't know, because we were different generations as well. Like my oldest sister is in her 50s. It was never like we were all at the home at the same time. I don't know if it really struck me that that was something that was very different. Also, my grandmother had 8 kids. And so like that was something that was part of my extended family. Mm-hmm. And like yeah. it made sense within that context. It did give me a lot of opportunity to like disappear. So like I could just get lost amongst all of the, because my mother was not only doing all this work with all of her kids, but also was managing this community. Yeah. And so I could just like, you know, figure out what I was doing myself. in the book I write about that is like, for a long time I felt that was something amazing that I looked forward to, just figuring out how to create my own little world amidst this, all of that was going on. And then I think as I got older, I started to like resent it a little bit more, and like wishing that there was more attention that could have been directed towards me. And then as an adult, I kind of have gotten back to that space where I'm just like, oh, that was a really amazing experience to have all these siblings and to like have built-in friends. And especially when you're being homeschooled, they're just there and you can always count on them to be around and support you. And family has always been a very big part of everything that I do because of that.
Right. I mean, Anna and I both have very large extended families, so we can definitely relate to that. But something that resonated from what you just said, and you mentioned it a little bit in the book, is this kind of rejecting things because you didn't have the language to know that you were queer. And that I felt the same way. I had a lot of anger personally towards religion from a very young age, because I just didn't understand why everything was like against what, I don't know. I didn't have the language to know what I was. And then I was angry. I couldn't express any emotion but anger. I'm curious, because you had such a large family, when you were kind of coming into the realization that you were queer, was there a family member that you went to first, or how did you kind of open that dialogue?
Yeah, I did it in a way that I like, actually, if I were to have that to do over, I wouldn't have done that. But I wrote all of my siblings like a letter at the same time. And I was like, this is what's up. And then I wrote my parents a letter also. But my siblings, and I kind of anticipated this, were always super supportive. And that wasn't really an issue. I think I mostly just sent it all to them at the same time because there's so many. And it's like just hard to have those individual comments over and over and over again. But, and we've had a lot of conversations about this recently, because it's very often that I just am like, oh, all of my siblings. And that's just like one unit, because we've been so tight in that way on my mother's side. And we kind of have similar relationships. But after I told them about my queerness, I started to build more individual relationships with my siblings. I mean, I think a big part of that was that inviting them in to this like unique experience in a way that, you know, can't just be wrapped up in our siblinghood and flattened into that. But growing up, it was kind of like, these are all my siblings. And like, I didn't really have any favorites or anyone that I was more particularly close with. Other than like my younger siblings, we have a different relationship, mostly just because they're younger and we're closer in age and we have the same father.
That's interesting. So, I mean, the idea of like sending them all, it makes sense. I can't argue with you there. Like, that's a lot of people to have to like have personal conversations with. And then also at the same time, like take on their sort of thoughts on it. It's like, you know, one and done. And then they can come to you if they really, really want to go deeper, which
it's like the equivalent of like an email chain or like a BCC or something. Like, just making it easier. That's pretty funny.
So being non-binary and like how you were able to approach that with your parents, because I feel like when I talk to my parents about such things, and my mom is Muslim and my father's secular, but they're both just they're Iranian immigrants who've been in America for a while. But I always feel like there's no way to explain anything to them, because to them, they're just like, what do you mean? How can you not identify? And you're like, well, you're trying to explain this concept to them that truly, I don't think has ever conceptualized in their mind, like ever. Like, they don't even know what you mean by non-binary, let alone someone ability to choose their own pronouns. Like, they can't figure it out. So I'm curious, like, what was that experience like for you to have these discussions with your parents specifically? Because I feel like older generations, I'm very interested in how they like perceive such things.
We haven't had a lot of conversations around like my gender and how I experience it and like what it means that I am that I don't identify on the binary. But we have had a lot of conversations about like what gender is and how the construct of gender is like, I think they can understand it in the terms of like gender as a construct that you as a Black woman were never able to really tap into, like didn't work for you. Mm-hmm. And so like, what does it mean to challenge that and reject that? And instead of just using, you know, non-binary, like talking about what it actually means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then situating it within the context of their life and their relationship to gender, and particularly as Black people who I argue in the book, like have never had like a normative relationship to these gendered ideas in the first place.
Right.
And so that was a lot easier to a conversation to have. I don't think my parents have ever used they, them pronouns for me,
yeah.
Which is I use he, him as well. But we have been able to have really productive conversations about that. And a lot of this work also has just been about being very public about the writing that I do. And like my mother followed me until she passed away. And so she would read things, mm-hmm. And then we could talk about it after. And that also like would open up avenues for us to have those conversations just because I was so publicly reckoning with these ideas in the first place.
That sounds like a really beautiful experience to have with your mother too, because I mean, as Anna said, like my parents in particular also don't understand. I think maybe part of it is because the Arabic language doesn't have even the terms yet or at all.
Yeah, there is actually no, in Farsi, there you don't have like a...
Yeah, they haven't advanced that much as far as how they think about gender to even consider like both Arabic and Farsi is like they're kind of just, if they don't have a word for it, then it's not real. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Even like if you were saying he eats or like writes and writes, if you're just like pointing at someone, if it's a woman and a man, it's different things. Everything is gendered. Every single verb is gendered. Is that how it is in Farsi too?
No, we don't have that.
It's like kind of similar to Spanish, I guess.
Right, right,
as far
yeah.
As,
huh.
That's concerned. So my name is Farsi, even though I'm Arab, and it means sweet. It's a very feminine name in Iran or in Persian. I knew from a young age I wasn't comfortable in my gender, and so I tried to go by Shane for a long time. My parents just like humiliated me and made me feel so silly to even try to like change my name, one try to go by different things. So yeah, I think I kind of accepted that like I just say any pronouns just because like I prefer they them usually, but she and her are both in my name, so I can't really deny that.
Right.
But I really love that you had that experience with your mom in particular, especially with something so personal as like a memoir, something that you've written about yourself, for her to really understand the inner workings of your process as growing up as a Black child. You know, I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And it really helped to like put it in terms of her, because her spirituality was such a big part of it. Putting into those terms, like Krishna is never supposed to be played in like plays. He's played by a woman.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And if you've seen pictures of Krishna, like he's very feminine. And thinking about gender through those terms is like, oh, I can understand yeah. why like there's feminine and masculine energies to God. And that was also another way that we were able to have some of those conversations. Not all of those conversations were productive, mind you. But just to answer Anna's question, that's how we were able to start getting into some of those.
Starting with spirituality, yeah. I guess, helps. Let's take our first break, and we'll be right back. We'll ask Hari all about their book. There are, like, quotes that I want to, like, I wrote down so many notes, but we'll be right back. And we're back with Hari Ziad.
So it's always that women play these, are they called like deities? No, I don't know.
I mean, they're depicted as women.
They're depicted as women.
They're depicted as feminine. Feminine. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're always kind of, in my opinion, non-binary.
Well, Krishna in particular, there are so many different type of deities, but Krishna is the main like God in Vaishnavism, which is what we call Hare Krishna. And Krishna is always depicted very feminine and like feminine qualities. His beauty is emphasized. Right. when you play Krishna in like any of the like dance and play stage performances, it's usually a woman that plays him. In like stories about Krishna, like for film and for TV, like there can be male actors and that's fine. But traditionally for the stage, women have played Krishna because of those reasons.
Right.
But that's very particular to Krishna. Not all deities are in the same
boat. That's interesting because I, you know, I've seen images of Krishna, but I've never really like, they don't even seem like a being enough to like be a gender, if that makes sense. Like I've never thought of it. Like, oh, it makes sense now that like they would have a woman play this god-like figure.
It's also pretty empowering when you think about that. That's kind of
cool.
I like that that bridge was crossed. Throughout this book, you're writing letters to your child self, which I thought was like beautiful. It really got me good because inner child work is just like so important for all of us to do. And I'm definitely going through it. But you have a Shondaland interview that talks about how you've coined this term in the book called misafropedia. So, and that's kind of the anti-Black disdain for children and childhood that Black youth experience. I'd like you to say in your own words, rather than me quoting this article, like, what, how did you come to coin this term? Where did it stem from? Like, what was that like?
For some reason, I don't really love the term coin, but I came up with this word because I struggled a lot when I was doing inner child work because the resources that my therapist gave me like really didn't reckon with the systemic issues that Black children face that causes the need for this work to happen. And so while I'm trying to like reckon with that and to position inner child work in a way that makes sense for me as a Black person, I wanted to name like what exactly those things were. And I think, I mean, we talk about, we know like that Black children are adultified in certain ways, like they're seen as older when in courtroom settings and things like that. We know about the school to prison pipeline and how that affects Black children in particular. And so I wanted to just bring all of those things together in order to explain how pervasive that is in all of our aspects of our lives and also to tie it to like the gender conditioning that Black children face. And there wasn't a word for that. And so I used the root word misopedia, which just means the hatred or disdain for children, and came up with this word to just sum all of that up to make it easier in the book and in all of my other work, which is always centering Black children, to just point to the entire system that's at work there. I was inspired in a lot of ways by Moya Bailey coining the term or popularizing the term misogynoir, which I think did a really great job of explaining the unique intersection of sexism and anti-Blackness that Black women face and allowed in the same way, I think, for conversations to be more streamlined around that because of this term. And I wanted us to have that same access when we're talking about Black children.
I think it's the first word in your book, which I thought...
Yeah.
And I didn't understand.
It's like the title of chapter.
Until I started.
Well, yeah, I think like, I assumed that I just didn't understand the word. And then I realized like, oh, they're explaining this to me now. And I mean, when you put it in the context of misogynoir, like that makes sense that it was like, I think we kind of need these new terms because there's an experience that's not defined by the language now. And so popularizing them is so important. So I'm really in awe that you were able to kind of like summarize this in a way that makes sense to you and then makes sense to all of us.
I mean, I feel Thank like you. We have tried to make this show a lot about similar concept to that, except for like children of like immigrants out of like, you know, Middle Eastern countries or any, honestly, immigrant, because a lot of us have a lot of very similar experiences. I don't even know what the word for that be.
We're going to have to coin it. We're popularized.
No, I just think it's there's so many parallels in that sense of like there's no space for you, like you're kind of like stuck in the in between, cuz like you have your place where you're with your family, but you're in America and your parents aren't like other kids' parents, and then you're in, you know, if you have the ability to go back to a home country of where your parents are from, like you're the American cousin or whatever. You'll be the British cousin or whoever, like, you, whatever colonizer country you, your parents immigrated to. Like, you, you right. just never, you never fit in. And so you just get, like, I don't know. I feel like growing up, I had obviously that problem, Shireen as well. Like, you just felt that there was, like, there's no place for you. And yeah. also, like, you don't have the tools to process that. So it's just like anger, you know, it for me.
It comes out in weird
ways.
Yeah,
it came out
like
as anxiety.
For me, it was anger, self-hatred.
Yeah, depression. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you just needed someone to be like, what you're experiencing is this. Yeah. And thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids in this country are also experiencing it. And I don't know. I feel like your book kind of taps into that feeling of like, oh, yes. Oh, of course. I shouldn't be so hard on myself. It's not just you, basically. You're not living this soul experience where it's like, why does it feel like the weight of the world is crushing me? When it's like, oh, wait, no. Mm-hmm. Literally, I like met Shireen and she was like, same. And I was like, oh, that's all I needed.
But imagine as a child how valuable having a term like that is. Like, same with, I mean, for like queer. Like, if we were more exposed to that term in the way that it is now, as middle schoolers or whatever, when I was really struggling, I would have felt a lot less just abnormal and stuff. And so it's the same kind of thing. Like, hopefully misophopedia can become almost popularized to the same extent where, like, if a child feels a certain way or, like, misogynoir or anything, I think those terms are valuable because they make experiences that previously could not be verbalized. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah. I hate to go back to this. I don't hate it, but it's just like the way that you talk to your child self. Like, I'm writing a lot of things that deal with my inner child work, and I bring myself to, like, I cry every time I imagine talking to my child, or if I even talking to her, like, out loud, I cry every time. And so I really, really loved those passages. In chapter one, there's a line that really, really got me. It starts with, I envision child me, little heart, Guara. Mm-hmm. A black boy struggling to wear their given name in a world that made it so hard to do, listening to my therapist's reassurance and finding some relief. It seemed so clear then. If I am ever to stop policing my inner child, I have to be free to explore how I was policed out of my childhood and how that was influenced by the state's dependence on all black people being policed. That was like, what? That was just like a, I mean, there were so many moments where I was just like, mic drop moment, which felt really lame to say out loud. But I don't know. There was so much of the child talk that I really, really appreciated. And I was wondering if that was difficult for you to tackle as a writer.
Yeah. Short answer is yes. But to be quite honest, like, in terms of like how those chapters came to me, I would sit and write those chapters much quicker than the other chapters. But that's not the same thing of like as how difficult it is, right? I think those chapters also took a lot more out of me, which is probably why they're more impactful. But I really thought of it in terms of like, it's just an extension of the work that I was doing in therapy already. And so like my therapist would tell me like, practice inner child work. And so instead of just like sitting there talking to myself, I'm like, I'm going to write. And then I'm like, oh, this can be a part of the book. And so that's kind of how I did it, like seeing it as like not just another piece of writing, not even really initially for a book, but for all of the things that you do inner child work for, to really investigate why the separation is there, what that aspect of you needs, and how you can provide that for you. And so after doing that work, I always felt a lot lighter and a lot closer to myself. And I understood a lot more of what I wrote about than I did before. And so it wasn't easy to do that work, but it was productive and it felt good. And it felt like, why else am I in therapy if I'm not going to be able to do this work? If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
That definitely does. That's interesting. Inner child work. My therapist never recommended that.
I mean, it kind of makes sense that, like, I feel like I haven't done enough therapy to maybe get to the point that you were at when you started writing these letters to yourself, that maybe, like, you had to have gone through these grueling sessions to understand, or like to, I'm assuming they're grueling. I'm definitely projecting here, but maybe you had to come to that point that was more like you had done a lot of work in therapy already to approach talking to your child self. And it shows. I think it's, I mean, one, I hope it popularizes inner child work because it's so essential to understanding yourself, especially because so many things are learned as children and then just implemented forever without us realizing. So yeah, I appreciated that a lot about your memoir.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know if it was as much as like I had to do a lot more practice of it in therapy, although that was helpful and we did do sessions there. But one of the things that really allowed me to do this and to like really get in the headspace quicker than it might be for other folks is I'd already been familiar with like altar work. Mm-hmm. And for me, that process of talking to my grandmother, for instance, felt very similar to the process of like inner child work. And so that I think I pulled more from than, I don't know if I was in therapy for a while. We definitely hadn't been doing inner child work for a while when I started doing this. But it helped me to do that process, to think about how I was doing that for my altar work already.
Can you describe a little bit what altar work is?
Yeah, so I have an altar that now has my mother and my grandmother on it, an ancestor altar, where I basically am doing very similar work of engaging these parts of myself, really, because they're memories of myself, talking to them, asking for guidance, working through things that we hadn't worked through before while they were here. And to me, that really just opened the idea that, you know, relationships don't end when the world says that they end. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I'll sit and talk to my grandmother if, like, I am struggling through a relationship and I want her particular energy. I'll sit and talk to my mother if, you know, what should I do with my father right now? Like, you would know what to say, and really putting myself in that mindset. And this is really hard, too. Like, I cry all the time for altar work.
But
it's not only tears. A lot of it, I think, in the same way, like once you get used to it, and especially when you're further out from the death, it becomes more natural, and you are able to be like, oh, like this is an actual relationship that I'm cultivating. That it's not just me sitting here to be sad about what I lost. It's also just, it's me reconnecting to those things. And there's so much joy in that too, when you can get to that stage. But I think to your point, like you have to start with being like, yes, I lost this thing and this was a huge loss and I need to grieve this loss. And then there's like another step where you're like, but it's not lost for good. And I'm going to cultivate a relationship with this thing or this person. And when you get to that stage is when I think this work gets a little bit easier.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of a better way to honor an important person in your life, or like an important memory of a person. I think that's, I putting myself in your shoes, I would, yeah. I mean, even my own shoes in that situation, losing people that I love, I would cry every time. And I could only imagine with years that passed, how much more natural that would seem.
Yeah. That is very interesting. And I'm thinking about it. I do have like a semi-altar to my grandmother who recently passed. And then weirdly enough, my mom, who's still alive, but I have some kind of weird issues, underlying issues there, which we won't get into. But I kind of create it because I, in a way, like my mom is a devout Muslim woman, but there's like she's still like a Persian immigrant. So there's like this disconnect of like emotion and like warmth there. She's not like the typical mother who wants to like hug you. She's actually kind of like a distant woman. And I put together this sort of semi-altar. It's mostly just like photos of her and my grandmother. And then one photo of me, because I look so similar to them that I'm like very fascinated by that. And I created that in a way to like, because I didn't get to, my grandma died right before the pandemic started, and not coronavirus related, but she just happened to pass away just right before. And also Iran got hit hard with COVID. So like I was going to go with my mom to Iran, and then last minute decided not to go because I had work stuff. And my mom went alone to Iran for my grandma's funeral and then was stuck there basically for the majority of COVID. Like, we couldn't get her out. And in that time, I created, that's when I put this altar together, because I just like, first of all, I didn't know what was going to happen to my mom. I was like, there's a chance she catches COVID in Iran. It was like a very like dark time for me. It was also very hard to get in contact with her because she's such a distant person that she just like doesn't call you back. And it's like the time difference was just like a mess. So like, I went through a really dark time where I was like, I didn't get to say goodbye to my grandmother. My mom's just out there. I have no connection right now to her whatsoever. And so I created this you know, semi-altar to like try and feel connected to them. And I would speak to it as if I was speaking to her and my grandmother. And, you know, now at the time, I didn't think of it as an altar. Like, now that I'm really, as you were speaking, I was like, I guess that was my altar. It still is. It still exists. It's right over there. But I felt like it, there was something about it, like, it almost felt more comfortable addressing the altar than, like, my mom's back. She's fine. She did catch coronavirus, but she had very mild symptoms and just, you know, made it back and was okay. Still distant, if you're listening, Mom, which she's not. But I still talk to it sometimes, even though, like, I could call my mom, but, like, there's almost, like, putting my emotions to this altar to like almost prep what I would say to her in real life or whatever in person has been my, like, how I've been coping with a lot of things, especially in like quarantine. And I honestly didn't realize healing. It until you just started talking about it. I was like, oh, that's kind of what I've been doing in my own way.
But that's like just evidence of it really being about your own, in my opinion, like, healing journey, you know, like even like your relationship with your mother, I think your impulse to do that just shows that, like, you're trying to understand it in your own way. You're trying to heal from it in your own way. And I think in long term, it would strengthen the actual relationship you have with her, because maybe you've come to understand the ways that you would want to talk to her, and maybe the ways that she doesn't reciprocate that. I don't know.
I also, I'm not without realizing it, went and got the exact same haircut as her. I don't know if that, because I've been just staring at her photos of her youth, that I like was like, I would want this cut. And then I came home and looked at the photo and I was like, and there you go.
Well, you look great. You look great. Turning into, let's take mom. Our last break and we'll be right back with more. And we are back. I'll pick one more quote to bring up that I thought was great. It's on page 136, and the title of the chapter, chapter 9, is Representation Matters? ? I think I get it now. When I was a child, disappearing to steal jam from the fridge, I didn't worry that I might end up separated from my parents forever. To be unseen doesn't always have to mean that I am erased. We don't need to see ourselves on their screens to know that we are not monsters. We know this before we learn otherwise. We have other platforms in our homes, in our neighborhoods, and in our communities that show us this naturally. We don't need to be seen in their media to be valued. We just need whatever is seen not to be used to erase our value. That's just, yes. Like, I think that's so eloquently put and, like, so important to kind of remember about representation, because it is their media, it is their award shows. And I always think about that whenever someone makes a fuss about the Oscars and stuff. I'm like, it's still theirs. It's, why do we want validation from these structures that have nothing to do with any of us? It's all theirs. So I really appreciate the way you worded that.
I'm glad that resonates. That's like my like the thing that I've been coming back to for years. And yeah, I get it. Like, it's not always that simple, like, especially, like, because so much of, like, how to make a living is tied to these things. But I think keeping that understanding in mind would really allow us to not, like, I think it's so traumatizing and re-traumatizing to people whenever, like, every year, and they're like, no Black people are nominated again, or, and then it's never enough. Like, if there are some Black actors, there are no Asian, there's no, it's never going to be enough, because these are systems that are set up to be exclusionary. Like, that's the way that they are made. And so, but also, like, to think about it in terms of something I think I was hinting at earlier, of like, I didn't really understand myself as being othered until, like, other people told me that. And, like, that's not a natural state. And so what does it mean that we fall back into like the things that they are telling us,
right?
Instead of falling back into like the state that we are born into, which mm-hmm. is like knowing, which like when you put it in that way, I think it makes perfect sense. Like we're born knowing that we matter, right. So we don't have to be told that until there's this other thing that happens. And so I think focusing on the interjection that happens there kind of just misses the point and defeats the purpose.
100%.
Yeah. Wow. You say a lot of things that make me have to think.
Ponder.
Yeah. I was in a, maybe I'm also just in like one of those states of minds these days where there's a lot going on. And I'm curious, you wrote for The Guardian. You wrote a lot about the election and race and what was going on there and America just, and politics just, you know, not even remotely understanding what was going on in its own country. But you wrote something in March about being an abolitionist and your sister being a police officer. And throughout your book, you are constantly talking about the Black experience in America. And very early on, I believe you are talking about your grandmother's passing and you're saying they said it was of natural causes, but, you know, the way nothing is ever the truth when a Black person dies. And mm-hmm. that, I don't know, that led me to like Googling stuff. Everything leads me to something else. I'm a bit, you know, I'm constantly pondering everything. But I found this article you wrote about your sister and your experience and, you know, the letter you wrote to your family. And I'm curious, like, I also want people to go read this article, which I'm going to link in the description. So go read it. So I'm not going to give too much away. But I'm curious what that experience has been like for you having a sister who I believe is a police officer in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
being an abolitionist, and then also kind of knowing where she's at in her life, and then also what's going on in this country. Like, what are your thoughts on all of this? Like, how do you reconcile a lot of this? Because I personally struggle a lot with reconciling like certain things like my parents do and what's going on in this country, like just the inherent racism that comes with being an immigrant in this country and like the colorism and what they feel like they need to be to survive in this country, which is, you know, the white supremacy ideals. Wow, it's kind of I asked you a very long question, but I'm curious, like, how you reconcile that.
Yeah. That's mostly what the article is about, is like me trying to do just that, because it's difficult. I don't know if I've fully reconciled that or if it's fully reconcilable.
Yeah.
It's definitely like an ongoing process. And I didn't want to, like, just presented like, I have all the answers of how you should deal with this. But the way that I tried to deal with it is by understanding, and it's the same way that I try to engage my mother around these issues and around like all of the other stuff that she had adopted that antithetical to liberation. Mm-hmm. But understanding where it came from, like this desire to be a police officer for my sister, is really rooted in a place that of her wanting to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's completely misguided. And so I think, and this is where I think so much of the work that I do and so much of the work that's called for to be done, particularly with Black people, is to just show us that something else is possible. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm engaging with my sister, it's from this place of like, you just don't even imagine that it's possible to do this in a different way. So you're like, yes, mm-hmm. the policing system is messed up. Yes, I experience racism daily on the job. Yes, I've seen some racist things happen. But this is, how else are we going to stop crime from happening? How else are we going to solve conflict?
Yeah.
And so I had to come to a realization that something else was possible too. And so I'm always just trying to engage with her with the desire to expand her imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the closest answer I have for like how I reconcile that. We still very much disagree on the matters of policing. One of the things that was very critical for our relationship is that I'm going to say what I'm going to say about policing. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not going to change just because you're a police officer. And once we got to that point where that was understood, our relationship has been a lot more healthy. But yeah, it's still a work in progress. Hopefully one day she leaves and she doesn't have to. We don't have to have this conversation anymore. But until then, I'm just always trying to do that work to explore what is possible and what kind of world we can live in, because we've been so limited in what we think conflict has to look like.
Yeah.
And what we think the solutions to that have to be.
Right.
Yeah. You had to come to an agreement. And I think I also kind of experienced that with my family, where I would always say, like, having a relationship between us it's not a right, you know, like, it's a privilege that we can, like, continue to talk and be a family. Like, in the end, like, blood doesn't necessarily always make it okay, you know? Like, I love you, but, like, I don't necessarily need to have a relationship with you if it's that, like, if it can be damaging to my own, like, state of being.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a lot to get into, but it's very, that's why I think your work is so interesting to me, because you bring a lot of, like, different aspects of, like, religion and family and, like, exploring, you know, gender, race, religion, being queer. Like, your experience is very interesting to me because I see so many parallels of my own life, and I'm very like fascinated with your ability to speak on it, because I feel like I just don't have the words. And I don't know if that's just like my own like fear of like forming those words, if that makes sense. Like, I get really scared. But I'm like, I also like, that's why I have this podcast. That's why we have this podcast, so we can like be better on speaking about certain things. But I love you. Yeah. What if that was it? My end is I love you. But yeah. It's truly like I really enjoy your work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Same. I'm curious. After being raised in such a spiritual household, both of your parents being spiritual in their own way, what is your relationship to spirituality now?
I have a much better relationship than I did when I was like just pushing away everything that I was ever taught, because so much of what was good about my childhood, so much of the things that I'd later unlearned, we were just talking about, like how we're born and we know that we matter. Like, that was intentional work that my mother did, and that she used her spirituality to try and create this space for us. And I try to think about it now as like the moments where her spirituality was like weaponized against me wasn't because it was with the parts of her spirituality that still needed to be shored up and built upon. And so now I think about like my spiritual journey as like an extension of my mother's, and like trying to build on the good parts of that. And where I am now is like my altar work comes from exploring hoodoo and African traditional religions, hoodoo being, you know, the religious practices that descendants of enslaved folks here in America have put together. And a lot of that is rooted in ancestral work.
Mm-hmm.
And so like my altar is a very big part of that. I'm able to see it more of like a religious and spiritual practice than what I imagined. Like, I used to be like, yeah, altar work is great. Hoodoo's work. Hoodoo is great. Like, the spiritual practices that we've carried, of course, they're going to be great because they resisted white supremacy. But I'm only now realizing that they're actual practices and like rituals, and like they're a reason why you do things regularly. The same reasons that you do inner child work, which is why I think inner child work is so similar, or it was so helpful for me to have done altar work to do inner child work, because it's a healing process. And right. So my spirituality has been the way that I've done so much of the healing work that's in the book and outside of the book, because I'm able to think of it as a larger healing practice that's part of a lineage of people trying to heal for centuries.
That's beautiful. I don't relate to the ancestral part, because obviously we're different, but I do really relate to this idea, because I rejected religion for a long time, and I'm still not religious, I would say, but I've realized that the internal work that I've done, the rituals that I do, they're spiritual in their own right. There's like a spirituality that we don't even realize that we're a part of. And that's been really interesting to me, to kind of come around to that, rather than like initially rejecting every notion of things that I presumed I wasn't a part of. But I do think it's so pivotal and like essential to do this internal work because, one, I think you'll be better for it. You'll be navigating throughout the world in a better way. And there's just something so healing. And I think I really appreciated that maybe the most out of your writing is that you've made this process of healing so, it's so vulnerable and it's so accessible, and almost it's normalizing it. It's okay to heal in a very public manner because you're here in front of us and you're thriving. And so, yeah, I think it's a testament to that. Yeah, we both love you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And I love you all. This conversation has been
so
amazing.
I didn't mean to say that as hard as like, you back. Have to return that.
No, but no, this has been one of the better conversations that I have. And I really appreciate you all having me on. And I'm so glad that it resonated in that way. That's exactly. I want people to gain more tools for healing, gain more tools for their own spiritual work. It can look very different from mm-hmm. mine. That's
of course,
fine. But
yeah.
Just knowing that this is something that's possible and something that you have to practice and something that you can get better at is why I wrote the book.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that. It's my journey is it's messy and I'm just coming around to like really taking it seriously in the last couple of years because running is so easy. But works like this, people like you are just like reminders that like, oh, it's worth it. It's definitely worth it in the end. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. Please tell people where they can follow you, your work, get your book, Black Boy Out of Time, just so they can keep up.
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at Hariziad. And you can, my website is also just my name, hariziad.com. And you can find links to the book on my website, but you can also find the book wherever you buy books online. My suggestion would be to order through your local bookstores. That's usually a very simple process. Even if they're not carrying it, they'll order it for you and then it benefits them instead of Amazon.
Yeah.
So yeah, just buy it from local bookstores, but you can get it wherever you buy books. And if you need a direct link, it's on all of my socials and on my website.
Nice. And all of Hari's socials will be obviously in the description box.
Yes, everything we referenced.
Or like the info cards or whatever the shit we're going to call it. But also links to their book and all of that good stuff. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on our show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's, yeah, same here. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Ditto. I can't believe I said ditto. This is Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Am, AMB on Twitter, Ethnically Ambig, AMBIG on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm just at Anna Hosnier on Twitter.
Yeah. And until next time,
go get Harry's book.
Yeah.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.